policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophists belong to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. This is one of the United Lodge situated around the globe. The periodical on the usher table is from whence we'll get all of the information we're sharing at this point. We have two meetings here in Philadelphia, Wednesday and Sunday, and we also have library hours. The library hours are Wednesday from 5:30 to 7:30, and the Wednesday meeting begins at 7:45 and lasts until 9 p.m. Wednesdays, we are currently studying In the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, and we are studying on the human constitution, and our class for this week will cover the subject of desire, the balance principle. On Sundays, the doors open at 10:30, and the meeting is not at this time guided by any literature that you can take home and prepare with, but it is usually a talk, a lecture, or a forum pertaining to the fundamental principles, and it's always time for questions and discussion after any presentations. The activities here are free and open to the public. All are welcome, and the activities are sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. All are welcome, all are needed, and no obligation is imposed or implied. It's just a freely given information. We'd just also like to take your awareness to the usher table again concerning independently produced theosophical impulse of ideas on those pages available also, and we have October and November available, Theosophical Independence, it's called. This morning, we're going to have, is it a lecture?
Yes.
We're having a lecture, a short talk, and our subject will be Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount. And in order to, by way of introduction and to set the tone, we have a short reading from the Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna speaking. Both I and thou have passed through many births, O harasser of thy foes. Mine are known unto me, but thou knowest not of thine. Even though myself unborn, of changeless essence, and the Lord of all existence, yet presiding over nature, which is mine, I am born but through my own Maya, the mystic power of self-ideation, the eternal thought in the eternal mind. I produce myself among creatures, O son of Bharata, whenever there is a decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And thus, I incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. Whoever, O Arjuna, knoweth my divine birth and actions to be so, to be even, so doth not, upon quitting his mortal frame, enter into another, for he entereth into me. Many who were free from craving, fear, and anger, filled with my spirit, and who depended upon me, having been purified by the ascetic fire of knowledge, have entered into my being.
Jesus Christ, after 2,000 years, still considered a controversial figure. Was it a real person? Was it an empty myth or legend? And if so, the impact that he's had on thought and action in the Western world is beyond measure. According to the Theosophical Glossary, under the word Ebionites, at least a century before chronological Christianity, Jesus was born and walked the earth. Lasu, or Jeshu, his personal name, was the son of Joseph Pandera and lived during the reign of Alexander Janius. Now, I say his personal name because Jesus and Christ are terms of designations of a certain accomplishments in a spiritual aspirant's life. Those aren't their true names. Just as Buddha is a certain designation, a certain point that a person reaches, aspirant reaches on a spiritual path. So this was not his true name. His true name, according to this, as far as we can see, was Jeshu or Lasu. And I believe that the difference in the spelling was due to interpretations from translation. But he was 100 years ahead of what the chronological Christian community says. It says that during the reign of Alexander Janus, from 103 to 76 BC, and he was put to death for sedition, as stated in the Scepter Tudos Jeshua, a Hebrew manuscript of great antiquity. Jeshua Jesus, according to every tradition, was educated in Egypt and passed his infancy and youth with the Brotherhood of the Essenes, who were the descendants of the Egyptian Hierophants, in whose country they had been settled for several centuries before they were converted to Buddhist monasticism by the missionaries of King Asoka. Some of these names that will be fine. If you remember and you ask me afterwards, I can go into more details. We're looking back through time at a particular figure who is at this time still misty to us. So there will be some things said that we may not be sure of or are new to us. The following quote from H.P. Blavatsky gives an idea of his status in the world of enlightened minds. In his time, the civilized portion of the pagans who knew of Jesus honored him as a philosopher, an adept whom they placed on the same level with Pythagoras and Apollonius. As an incarnated God, there is no single record of him on this earth capable of withstanding the critical examination of science. But as one of the greatest reformers, an inveterate enemy of every theological dogmatism, a persecutor of bigotry, a teacher of one of the most sublime codes of ethics, Jesus is one of the grandest and most clearly defined figures in the panorama of human history. Jesus or Jeshu, like Siddhartha Gautama the Buddha, was a reformer. He revealed knowledge that had been kept secret by the religious hierarchy. He labored on behalf of humanity by informing the common people that God was to be found within, not separate from themselves. He saw and revealed a universal religious synthesis. That is to say, all religions share a common root. In short, he taught what we now refer to as theosophy. Avatars and enlightened souls can be best understood in the light of other avatars and enlightened souls. The teachings that they bear witness to are eternal. No true avatar or enlightened soul claims to be unique. No true avatar claims to present a new message. Instead, they verify those who came before and point to those who will come after. And there's a cyclic rhythm to their appearance among humanity. As we've illustrated from the Bhagavad Gita in this morning's opening reading, which I will repeat part of now, I incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. In the New Testament, Jesus is reported saying, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." Krishna, another member of that elect brotherhood, states in unison to that idea, "I am the embodiment of the supreme ruler and of the incorruptible, of the unmodifying, and of the eternal law, and of endless bliss." Similarly, Buddha, in agreement and harmony, is reported saying, "You are my children. I am your father. Through me you have been released from your suffering. I myself, having reached the other shore, help others to cross the stream." We can see a pattern a consistent idea repeated by those illumined souls at different times, in different places, and to different audiences. What Jesus offers to the Jews in his time isn't different from what his peers offered to a misguided humanity in their times. When any illumined soul speaks of I or me, they're not speaking of a historical personality, but of their divinity, their identity with the universal self, which is boundless and transcends both time and space. Buddha appeared at a time when spiritual culture in India was at a low ebb, consisting mostly of rituals and sacrifices. The people had forgotten the purpose of religion, that its primary matter is a matter of direct experience. When Jesus appeared among the Jewish people, they had begun to lose sight of the true meaning and purpose of their religion. There was more attention being paid to the trappings than to the essence. He, like the Buddha and others, came to reform a straying people. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. This is the central theme of the Sermon on the Mount. The purpose of our lives is to seek perfection and realize fully our divine nature. These teachings of Jesus, which emphasizes not just moral teachings, but spiritual teachings as well, are found in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 5, 6, and 7. Today, we'll examine four sections or topics: Beatitudes, Law, Prayer, and Treasures. Time restrictions will not allow us to do an in-depth study of the subjects in these presentations. We can only offer samples, but that doesn't constrain the questioning of the entire subject by you, the audience. An amazing fact becomes clear when you begin to study the different religions. You begin to discover echoes. Jesus says in Beatitudes, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." This speaks to the primary characteristic a disciple or a chela must possess before he can accept spiritual knowledge: humility. True wisdom of a spiritual kind is freedom from self-esteem, hypocrisy, and injury to others. It is patience, sincerity, respect for spiritual instructors. That's from the Gita, page 95. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Meekness is considered weakness. But Lao Tzu reminds us that in the world there is nothing more submissive and weaker than water. Yet for attacking that which is hard and strong, nothing can surpass it. And the another thing that Lao Tzu said about the weakness, he said that rigidity was associated with death. Suppleness and flexibility were associated with life. The Tao said of that, "The great man, his face and form blend with the great unity, which is selfless. Being selfless, how can he look upon possessions as possessions?" Law. "Think not that I come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." This is the mission of every divine incarnation or avatar. What is it that he comes to fulfill? Truth from falsehood and ignorance. "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." He has come not to destroy the eternally existing truth, but to fulfill it. This he does by restating it, giving it new life, presenting it in a new way. Humanity often forgets that these presentations of divine incarnations are meant to be unfolded in their own lives. They hold fast to the message, but they forget that within the message is an undying spirit which they should grasp. Prayer. And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into a room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. To make a show of holiness is to court public recognition and the rewards that it brings. But at the same time, it is rejection of that indwelling spirit. What should be a sacred act becomes instead a performance. This same principle applies also to charity. It's not to be done for show. We're encouraged to free ourselves from the attachments, from the cravings for the fruit, from the fruits of our actions. The Bhagavad Gita says, we must learn to offer the fruits of our work to God. Treasures. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. This is to remind us of what is eternal and what is temporary. The ability to discriminate between the two helps to decrease our thirst for the transient treasures of the senses. And Buddhism says, the impulse I want and the impulse I have, lose them. That is where most people get stuck. Without those, you can use your eyes to guide you through this suffering state. Questions? Yes, ma'am.
Paraphrasing what was read was something like, be ye pure as your Father in heaven is pure, or holy.
Be ye perfect.
Perfect, thank you. Is the Father in heaven representative of an outside spiritual force or something within? And either way, how do we reach to it?
Heaven resides within us. Heaven isn't an outside place so much. It's something that resides within us. And to be perfect, what it's saying to us is the perfection that we seek isn't a relative perfection. In our own lives, we have times when we're happy and feel successful, but those who observe their lives know that following the happiness and the success usually is pain or disappointment. It's that roller coaster ride that we all are on from time to time, up one day, down the next. This perfection that they're speaking of is a perfection beyond this and that. It is a soul perfection. It is the essence of perfection. It is the perfection of the universal mind. There is no yang. There is no yang. There is no time. There is no space. It exists perfectly within itself. And there are those who reach that state. It is not an unreachable state. In fact, that is the message that each of the avatars gives us. They have ascended, they have, and perhaps ascended isn't the right word, they have become absorbed in that particular, in that universal mind. They still are on earth, we see them, we can deal with them, they can sit next to us, but there's something about them that is above and beyond anything that we can comprehend with our sense of reasoning and our grasp, our intellectual grasping. So that's the perfection that they're speaking of. Yes, sir.
It was described the what historical record we have of an individual living that time in comparison to the traditions that rose up. Did this individual actually give a sermon called the Sermon on the Mount, or is that something that was fashioned by his followers for his teachings?
Well, through all the studies that I did, I couldn't really tie that individual to that sermon. And the few things that I did say that was written by someone else. The person that it was written by, though, according to what I did see, was himself an adept, was himself a person well on the path. But I leave that open to anyone else who can contribute to it, who might know with more certainty. Yes, ma'am.
The thought that occurs is that so many of these great avatars around the globe never wrote anything down. In the time periods that they were working, it was mouth to ear, and it was morality stories, parables that the people could absorb at the time, and many of the writings are recorded later. So that's probably the case with this.
Yes, that's pretty much what I found, that it was attributed to him by someone who possibly didn't even know him. But the historical figure, the interesting thing about the historical figure, what the historical figure offered was almost like a dress form. You know, seamstresses, they have these forms, and they drape the fabric over it and figure where the seams come in and how to sew it and make it a fit. What he offered was a dress form. Even with Jeshu, or the one we call Jesus, Apollonius is also mixed in with that form. Apollonius was another adept, very brilliant, and brilliant doesn't even go far enough. Another shining example of perfected beings, and he lived in those times also. Some of the things that are attributed to the Jesus of the New Testament are actual supposed to be feats that he, Apollonius, had done. Yes, ma'am?
A question about the instructions on prayer.
Yes, ma'am.
Part of Matthew is the statement about praying in one's heart rather than doing a public display of worship. What would be some advice given about praying in the closet of one's heart?
Well, we speak of, often we'll hear in these rooms, of an indwelling spirit, of a hierarchy even. And that is really where our conversation, the dialogue of our conversation, takes place. So when you say that there's prayer in your heart, it's you're speaking to the best and the highest part of your existence. You're speaking to that which is directly from the Oversoul or the universal mind. Is that where we were? Yes. Yes, sir.
We think in the translation or the version of the life we have of Buddha by Sir Edwin Arnold, the Light of Asia, there's a phrase there that goes, pray not for the gods, they will not answer. In yourself, deliverance must be found. How does that relate to what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount about true prayer?
Well, not just the prayer itself, but also when Jesus speaks of when Jesus speaks of the being perfect. That perfection he is seeking is not outside of ourself. In fact, that was the message that he came with, is to that there is that what we seek, that perfection, that God that we speak of, is in us. It is not outside of us. It is not something that we have to go to. It's not as has been properly put forth for many, many years here in the West, as something dwelling out in space. It has no dwelling in space, or it has a dwelling in space, but it has a dwelling within you. There is nowhere that you can go to escape it. It is everywhere. It is like we, in the first fundamental, when they speak of space itself, the very idea of space is that it is in you and you are in it. You cannot step outside of it, but if you could step outside of it, you would not be missed, because it is complete within itself. Yes, ma'am.
So then everything spiritual and divine residing within, how do we become aware of that? Is there a practice? Is there a method? Do we need to sit quietly? Is there an idea of a good way to begin to reach that?
Well, the foundation for a spiritual life actually starts in a method, in an ethical and a moral life. Like building a house, the foundation is laid first, and then you lay the superstructure on top of it. Think of your spiritual life as being the superstructure. Think of the foundation for it as being your moral and ethical life. Yes, ma'am, a follow-up?
So, yes, thank you. So are you saying ethically and morally, if we are following the ideas of conscience, perhaps, if we're listening to that voice, we're probably on the right path?
The voice of conscience cannot be overstated. The voice of the conscience is that highest part of ourselves speaking to us directly. If we put ourselves in such a way that we can, that we listen to it, that we recognize it, that we hear it, and obey it, it will lead us to, the voice will become stronger, and so will we. Yes, ma'am.
And that's probably why it's called the voice of silence, because each one of us at some time in our lifetime, we've known if something was right or wrong. There's something within us that just knows, within our nature. We can go against it, we can pretend it's not there, but there is that knowing. Is that part of that spiritual part of our nature, that part that knows?
It is a part of our spiritual nature. And the interesting thing, or at least I think interesting thing, much of the great literature that we have at our disposal is in reference to that quiet voice, that voice of the conscience. In many of Shakespeare's drama, the person who's central to the plot betrays that voice and spends the rest of the play in some sort of hellish condition, being plagued, knowing that they did wrong, knowing that what they did was wrong. All of this is that signs and signals and incidents that happen that remind us. We might read it, or we might hear of it, or someone, you know, tells us about it. But all of these are signs and signals. They all come from the same source. It's not always, people think the voice of the silence is something that you only hear in your ear or in your mind. It is all around you. Yes, sir.
But apparently, Jesus was aware that not everyone could hear the voice of their silence. He says to his disciples, those apparently they could, that to you I give the mysteries, the kingdom of heaven, but to others I speak in parables. Well, why did he have to speak in parables? Why couldn't he just give them information? Why did he have to speak in symbols.
Some people don't progress all at the same time, and one size doesn't fit all. Often, one person, possibly in the same family, brothers, one brother will hear that voice, and the brother sitting right next to him at the dinner table can't hear it. That's not to say that he's a bad person. It's not to say that he doesn't hear something, but it's not as powerful in each as it is in the others. And if you know, and these avatars do know, they can tell who is ready by their actions, by what they do. Give to them what they need. To the others, give to them what they need. And when you read the parables, actually, if you take with you an open heart to the parables, everything that he's telling the disciples are locked within the parables. It's according to what device you intend to carry away your fortune, a teaspoon or a Mack truck. But it's all there. Yes, ma'am.
I was listening to some sermons about why he spoke in parables, and they said it was to trip up the people who are all-knowing and the Pharisees and to put them in their place, so to speak. Because when he does give a parable, he, for example, the sower of the seed, he also explains later what he meant. It's not just a parable and, okay, this is a mystery and you figure it out. He goes back and explains it. But I was taught that that's one of the reasons to trip up the people full of themselves.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, if you think of the parable as a lock.
A lock?
A lock. Okay. Lock on a door. Okay. If you think of the parable as a lock and you think of the earnestness and sincerity and patience as the key, you can see those who come without patience, those who come without earnestness, those who come with hearts that are less than purified can look right at it and they'll never see it. It's not that it's hidden, it's that because they're not prepared to see it. And in some instances, they don't want to see it. Because of the life that they're living, they are happy right at that particular time with the pleasures and the rewards of the senses. And anything that would disturb that, they don't want to see, they can't see. Even some who are really in earnest, who are really good people, who are what we would consider moral and just people, they can't open it all the way and get full out of it because they have attachments to what is. They are still dealing in the rewards of their actions. If you noticed in the document this morning, it says in the Gita, you turn over the reactions to God from your actions. You don't accept them. You divest yourself of them. That is the person who can open the parables all the way, or that door to the parables all the way. Yes, ma'am?
And sort of along the lines of what you're saying, we don't think a teacher or a reformer would hold back from anyone. If we use the analogy, perhaps, of sunshine, the sun shines equally on the greatest sinner and the greatest saint. There is no distinction except that which that soul has made by effort or lack of effort. So we don't think there would be a purposeful discrimination as was described, but as better described by the chair, as the one is ready, they shall receive it or understand.
It's just, yes, ma'am.
If you have a wise teacher, they're going to be very discriminative. They are not going to give matches to children to let them just play as they will. So we think while a teacher would never hesitate to share, a teacher knows better than to just indiscriminately give out wisdom, because it's always a two-edged sword. You can hurt yourself with power,
So we think a teacher would hesitate.
Yes. It is a two-edged sword, and you're right. Just as it can help, it can also hurt. And the teacher, that's one of the reasons that he becomes a teacher. He has the ability to discern, to tell who is ready and who is not, who he could give these to, who he can take them to. And they say that the really great teachers, it's not just words. They have the ability to touch you in certain ways so that you not only hear it, you understand it, you realize what they're saying. So they have that ability and that gift also. I saw your hand, sir.
Yes. Isn't the Sermon on the Mount an echo of the Buddha's teachings, an exact, really, replication of what was given out 500 years earlier in a slightly different part of the globe? But during that period, there was a lot of trade and intercourse between peoples. So these ideas were out there and were apparent, but Jesus was a witness on the scene because they were about to be withdrawn from the general public. And the tough times were coming, and these ideas, he was out there to recapitulate the teachings of the Buddha and Lao Tzu and others.
That's true. As a matter of fact, there, as you go through these, like I said, it's almost like echoes. You hear one teacher say it, and you read, and then you find it's almost the same thing said by another teacher. But what that does is it testifies to the fact that true avatars don't change the truth. They don't come with a new truth. It's the same truth. And as far as reestablishing or keeping that on the scene, yes, that was part of the job of the author at the Sermon on the Mount. But Jesus and the Buddha, they shared, those two souls shared quite a bit, and they had quite a bit in common. There are some, and I'm sure someone here knows of it, there are some who say that there was a saint who was supposed to have been the Buddha, a Christian saint. This is very difficult to explain, but as you go back and you start looking at these things, names change, locations change, but there's a sameness that runs through all of this that is almost phenomenal. St. Augustine said that Christianity existed it's always existed. It's given the name Christianity at that particular time, but what Christ was teaching always existed. But the name is given the same. And the same thing with what we're saying this morning. What they taught is what is being taught here, but we refer to it as theosophy, but it is the same thing. It is the same principles. It is the same goal. Yes, sir.
Follow. And that saint is St. Josephat. And
exactly.
HPV talks about that the Roman Catholic Church canonized that saint, which they often did to,
absorb.
They absorbed in the legends and the myths of the people as they expanded. There's actually a parish in Mount Yonk named that.
St. Jehovah's Fan. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Well, just thinking, we think it was George Bernard Shaw who said, Christianity has not failed. It just hasn't been tried yet.
True. Interesting thing, too. I want to read this a little bit, and then I'll get to you. It is so difficult. We are so far from I mean, the situation that we're in, to follow the Sermon on the Mount, it's we're almost diametrically opposed to that in the standards of our society. If you read, when you read the teachings of Jesus, he says, Jesus doesn't equate power with work, money, planning, saving, or accumulation. All of it, all of which are required to amass power, wage war, and divide the strong from the weak. All of this is done and given the blessings of the Western religions through the Protestant work ethic. The structure of our society is in complete opposition to almost everything that is proposed in the Sermon on the Mount. In a market economy, you need to be ambitious and competitive. In other words, you display what is described in the Gita as the Rajas principle, Rajasic principle, of which we are informed is a life ruled by desire, passion, and submission to the rule of the senses, eventually becoming a life of pain. Yes, ma'am.
And we as soul have incarnated into those conditions. So if we live mindfully and use those conditions, so work as someone who is extremely driven, but then earn that money and apply it to charity. There are ways to work within the conditions to transmute and lift them.
Yes, it is. And that is a challenge. Yes, sir. You had your hand raised.
Oh, that was with respect to a couple speakers ago when he suggested that there was Buddhist influence in the Sermon on the Mount.
Yes, sir.
And one indication of that is one of the miracles, so-called, of Jesus is that he fed the masses at the Sermon on the Mount from baskets of fish that could be explained. And, of course, really, even back in Catholic school, we remember being explained that those baskets of fish were symbolic of ideas and teachings. You know, it wasn't literally taught to us as fish, but the similarity or the indication that it's of Buddhist influence is the basket. Because in one of the languages of Buddhist
Could you just speak up just a little bit?
One of the languages of Buddhist countries is that books are referred to as baskets. And the ideas in the books are what are important. When the ideas are consumed, the basket is thrown out, so that we don't have a society worshiping books, but rather applying the ideas.
Thank you so much. That was a great contribution. Yes, ma'am.
But there is also the fact that an adept could feed the multitude with a loaf of bread and one fish, because they're in charge of matter and space and time. But the point would be that the people would be hungry again, so that wisdom, as was said, wisdom given out, however it's given out, is worth more than food. But no adept would let the people starve. It's only the rest of us that would.
We go back to that off-recorded saying from the, I think, the 60s or the 50s, teach a man, give a man a fish and he eats one, teach him a fish and he can feed himself. Yes, ma'am.
And it translates to the Eastern idea of starting each day with an empty bowl. And whether we equate that to food or ideas, in other words, if our bowl is filled, we don't need anything. We're not in a receptive mode. We can't hear. We can't fit anymore in there. If we empty our bowl, we may be hungry, but we're also ready to receive new ideas, just as we would need food. So that's how we should approach it, with an emptiness and ready to consider what we hear, what we're given, and transmute that into something pure and divine.
And that directly relates to blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The poor in spirit are the humble. Your bowl is empty. When you have pride in your learning, pride in your beauty, pride in your wealth, pride in anything, it acts as a deterrent from your bowl being filled. How can someone tell you I'm successful? How could you possibly think that you could inform me of anything? I'm cuter than you are. I know more than you do. I've got this. I've got that. You have to empty that bowl before you can accept it. And this is what they're saying in Blessed Are the Poor in Spirit. They are humble. They've come ready to have their bowl filled from a true teacher. There was a, and I thought it would come up, but it didn't. But resist not evil, which is a big contention among quite a few people who read it. What does that mean? Does it mean that you should surrender to the evildoer? Should you? And I'll put it out there as a question from the chair and see what. Yes, ma'am.
I thought the best example of that is a swinging door. If you push a swinging door very hard, it's going to come back and slap you. If you move it gently without resistance, then you move around it. There was a 6 or 7 volume set of a novel, science fiction, based on this very question, how do you defeat evil? And it ends with, you don't fight it, you resist it. Otherwise, you give it the power to grow.
Exactly. Yes, yes, sir.
Isn't it said of what Buddha is teaching in the Dhammapada, hate does not cease by hatred, but only by love?
You snatched that right out of my hands. No, that was a perfect example of that. But it's a stumbling block for quite a few people. It's a difficult proposition to understand because it says resist not evil. It's given, you get the impression that you should submit to evil, but it's not submitting to evil. Just one moment, your red shirt you had.
We were thinking about water earlier, and that it seems so harmless, but it can be when it's energized, it's the most powerful source there is. And in a way, it's more powerful than fire, because fires, even though they can cause incredible destruction, it seems like a tsunami will trump that any day.
It's a universal solvent too, which is one of the keys to why it is what it is.
And maybe with the evil thing, it's like that water doesn't resist it, so use that as a thought.
Yes, ma'am.
With that idea, resist not evil, maybe when we think about what does that mean, we could think that it's resist not change, resist not the unknown. Resist not what you don't understand. It's, it's just called evil, but evil could be change, it could be, it would empower your faith to not resist what you don't know or what you fear.
To remain flexible.
To just not resist what you fear, like, that's when you get those times when you stand alone in the self and balance from the middle or whatever. Like everyone has to survive. That's like a epitome of where you're going to become aware of that.
Yes, sir, you had your hand up.
Yeah, but also, without being quite so abstract, evil can be viewed as just the malintent from people around you who are kind of low consciousness. And the interesting thing about that is, don't meet them where they are, let them operate, and kind of like an expert in judo, that just let them use their power against themselves, and there's very little effort, because it's just going to come right back around to them. But if you do stoop down and play that game, could well be that they're much more expert at that game than you are.
Plus, you contribute to it. One of the things that I did read in a part of it, it says, you know, you, not to argue.
Yeah.
And the reason for not arguing.
Don't fight back. Be a problem.
Yeah. And the reason for not arguing is that it interrupts that connection that you have with your higher self. You have to stop that in order to argue with someone. And that is the reason why it says, you know, whatever it is, end it quickly so that you can get back to what is truly important. The arguing is only a manifestation of your ego. I'm right. I know. I, you know, to have it over someone else. Yes, sir.
But didn't Jesus resist evil when he threw the money changers out of the temple?
That's a very good question.
Well, at least that's the story.
Yes, yes.
So there must be something more than involved with that than just being flexible and letting it go and not taking a stand. There must be more than not resisting evil, than just being passive.
One of the interpretations of the Gita, it says, rather than it doesn't say to dispel evil, but to expel evil deeds. Not to person, but the person who is committing the deeds. And I'm wondering if that works on that level too. Yes, 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 sir.
I found that spiritual evil, if given love, it dispels itself and is self-transforming.
True.
For both people, the betrayed and the betrayer.
That's similar to what the Buddha said as far as it being in the heart. You can't dispel hatred with hatred. You can only dispel hatred with love. We have time for a few more questions. I'm going to go to the young lady there.
Just a comment on the money changers. If we look at that as an application of the conscience reacting on principle, that there's still spirit-centered activity, and the Christ, the enlightened one, resisting no evil, observing everything that's going on at the personal level, not worrying about what public opinion might be or the flack that that person might receive, but acting on spiritual principle by conscience and then reforming with that, turning away from trying to be attached to the evil or the response of the evil, and detaching, not being worried about the actions and what would come after, just acting on spiritual principle.
I'm going to read this short, this brief idea, and then we'll have time, I think, for one more question. Although non-resistance has been taught in every great religion, most people cannot understand it. A soul who has achieved this state of understanding realizes his union with his higher nature and is able to see the divine existence in all things, and all, existence in all things and being, and lives in universal love. Further on, Jesus says, "Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." In other words, to follow this truth in our lives would lead us to perfection and make gods of us. Yes, yes,
well,
ma'am.
As we recall, Jesus did not say these beings are evil because they are money changers. He said, don't do this here in this place of sacredness. Take it away. So we think there's a big difference between confronting an evil or something wrong in a location as opposed to challenging or resisting the evil coming from someone.
Thank you so much. This is the end of the class. I hope everyone has the rest of the day is as great for them as this part, as this has been for me. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did too. And we hope we can see you on Wednesdays.
Thank you.